This is the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Mormon Expression. This is Heather, and I am going to be hosting this episode alone. That's right, they've left me to my own devices for this episode, so hopefully I don't mess it up. Today I have the pleasure of interviewing David Campbell, the author of a book, American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us. It was published in 2010, and it looks at the current state of religion in the United States and some different aspects of how we interact with each other and how religious people are perceived and that kind of thing. So welcome to the podcast, David.
Well, thank you for having me.
So why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, let's see. I graduated from BYU in 1996, and I then went to Harvard, where I earned my PhD. And since earning my PhD, I have taught political science at the University of Notre Dame. That's my academic background. You might also be interested in knowing that I am, and this comes as a shock to many people, not an American. I was born and raised in the great nation of Canada. And so I always feel like I'm a fish out of water. I'm a non-Catholic, non-American who teaches American politics at a Catholic university.
That is kind of surprising, actually. All right, so you wrote the book. Oh, I guess before we get into the book, I should ask you, are you a lifelong member of the church?
I am. My parents are not, but I am. And the fact that my parents are not is actually relevant to the story we tell. That is my co-author, Bob Putnam, and I. The story we tell in American Grace, where we talk at some length about the religious mixing and matching that Americans, and I guess I can say North Americans, find in their own families and in their friendship networks. So in my case, while I'm a lifetime member of the LDS Church, my parents are not, which means that I have many relatives on both sides of my family who are not LDS, and that is an example of the sort of religious mixing and matching that we describe in the book.
So did that prompt you to pursue investigating religious interplay between people and how people choose different religions as opposed to just, well, sometimes choose different religions instead of just sticking with the ones they were born with? Is that what kind of sparked this book?
That's a good question. I wouldn't say that's what sparked the book. The book actually was born out of an idea that Putnam, who had been my dissertation advisor when I was in graduate school, that he and I came up with about 5 years ago. We knew we wanted to write something. We figured it would result in a book on the role of religion in American society. But as we got into it, it became clear that the fluidity in the American religious environment was going to be a very important part of our story. And then one consequence of that fluidity, the fact that people move around and there are sort of shifting boundaries of different religions, we figured that was going to be an important part of actually many aspects of our analysis. And my co-author, Putnam, his background is even more an example of this sort of religious moving around than mine, because he himself is a convert to Judaism. He was raised a Methodist, converted to Judaism. And then within his own family, he's had multiple children and then also nephews and nieces and siblings who have moved into different religious traditions or just ceased to be religious altogether. So between the two of us, we actually cover a lot of religious ground within our families.
Definitely. So the book is very long. It's like 550 pages without the appendices and the references and things. And you guys cover a lot of really interesting topics. But for this podcast, I want to focus primarily on the Mormon topics and the things that you found out about Mormonism. The first one being, and it came very early in the book, was that according to the study that you did, Mormons are the most observant. I don't know if that equates to being the most devout, but they are considered, from your study, they are the most observant of all the denominations. Is that correct?
That's right. The way to think about that finding is whenever you try to study religion the way social scientists do, you have to come up with some way that you can compare members of different religions across religious groups. And that's a little tricky to do because, of course, different religions believe different things and they do different things. So you have to kind of come up with questions that can be translated from Protestantism to Catholicism to Judaism to Mormonism. And so this measure that we use that we call the Religiosity Index doesn't actually say anything, we don't think anyway, specific about any particular religion. It's a combination of things. It asks, first of all, how frequently you attend religious services, how strongly you believe in God, whether you are a strong believer in your religion, how frequently you pray outside of religious services, and a few other things, but they all hang together empirically. And when you put all those things together into an index and then compare members of different religious traditions, it is the case that Mormons come out as the most religiously observant, or the most, I guess the safest thing we can say is they score highest on this religiosity index. They're a little bit ahead of the Black Protestants, which is the other group that's highly religious in the U.S.
Right. It was also said in the book that Mormons are the least likely to lapse or to switch to other faiths. And I might have been looking at the bar graph wrong, but it looked like only about 25% of Mormons leave faith in favor of another religion. And then either 20% just completely lapse altogether, for a total of like 45%.
That's right. The good news, I suppose, for Mormons, or at least for church headquarters, is that the Mormon retention rate, as we sometimes call it, is high compared to other religions in America, but it's still not terribly high. You know, that means that if you count those who switch to another religion plus those who lapse or become inactive, as we'd say in LDS parlance, that's still roughly half of the whole LDS population. That's a pretty big chunk.
Yeah, definitely. Now, did you use, to come up with this number, you used figures that were specific to your study, right? You didn't look at the way the church qualifies full-time or observance.
That's correct. The way we generate those sorts of statistics, and there's a lot of them in the book, is We did this massive study, a survey of over 3,000 Americans, in which we asked them every imaginable thing about their religious background, about their civic life, about their families, sort of anything you'd want to know. And among those questions, we asked not only about their current religious affiliation, but whether they had ever been anything else. So what were they raised? And we also asked about their parents and their spouse. So we wanted to know all sorts of things about their religious trajectory. And this measure of retention is actually based on their current religious affiliation as reported by themselves. So just, what are you, Methodist, Mormon, Jew, whatever, compared to what they themselves say they were when they were a child or an adolescent, actually.
Okay. So something that I found interesting, and this might not be terribly surprising, or it might not lead to any interesting discussion or anything, but according to your study, it looked like Jews and Mormons were the most committed to marrying within their faith. And the next little bit of information showed the rates at which people intermarry into other religions, and Mormons and Jews didn't top that list. Evangelicals and Black Protestants and Latino Catholics were ahead of Jews and Mormons. So did you guys notice that?
I don't know if I've ever actually thought about it quite that way, the difference between what people prioritize in their attitudes and then what's reflected in their behavior. There is actually kind of a straightforward explanation for the differences, and that is the smaller the group within the population, so Jews and Mormons, of course, are small groups in terms of their numbers, the more likely they are to intermarry because of what we would call a pool effect. The pool from which they're drawing their potential mates is a lot smaller.
Okay.
But it's still nonetheless striking, isn't it, that you do find that disconnect.
Definitely.
And of course, it's particularly striking because for slightly different reasons, but reasons that are not entirely dissimilar, both Judaism and Mormonism actually emphasize marrying within the faith as within Mormonism, it's certainly a theological precept, and you could probably say the same for Jews. If it's not theological, there's a strong cultural expectation that you marry within
Definitely.
Judaism.
All right. So another thing that really surprised me was the chapter about women in the church, Well, Women in Religion. You guys asked people whether or not they were opposed to female clergy. And according to the responses you got, only 52% of Mormon men are opposed to female clergy, while 90% of Mormon women are opposed to female clergy. Are we safe to assume that that means holding the priesthood?
Yeah, although we don't actually have to, we don't phrase it that way, but I don't see how a Mormon could interpret that question in any other way.
Mm-hmm. What do you suppose the reason for that is?
It's interesting you ask that. This finding was also highlighted on the website of the Women's Exponent 2.
Mm-hmm.
And I even contributed a little bit. They have a blog, you know, where people leave comments on the various things that are posted. Because a number of people had noted this and were curious about it. I think the finding's real, but I do want to qualify that a little bit. Because we don't have all that many Mormons in the study to begin with, so it's a massive study. Like I said, interviewed over 3,000 people, but even with 3,100 respondents, that still only works out to 50-some Mormons. It's the right number. It's the number we should get, but it's still a relatively small number.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when you slice that group basically in half, men versus women, that means you're talking about a pretty small number of respondents, people, on which to base any conclusions. So this is the way I would phrase it. I'm comfortable saying that Mormon men are more comfortable with the idea that women would hold the priesthood than are Mormon women. But I wouldn't put too much on the precise numbers we report just because there would be a large margin of error, as it's often called, or more technically a confidence interval around those two numbers. And I think part of that is actually explained again by the easy exit out of religions in America. And so I suspect that many women who are bothered by the role of women in the church have ceased to call themselves Mormon. Plus, there's probably also a lot of contemplation, thinking, maybe even rationalization that goes on the part of Mormon women about the role of women in the church. They've probably thought about it a lot more than most men have, actually.
Right, yeah, because it affects them. So I've heard, and I don't know where I came across this, but I heard that one of the reasons might be that it's part of the Mormon culture for women to deny wanting the priesthood. And it's how they, it's one of the ways that they signify that they're a good, devout Mormon woman, that they, not not have that aspiration. Did you have any discussions or have you come across that notion at all?
I have. I don't have a way to test that. It's very difficult, actually, to test that sort of thing because it's based on a norm within a subculture. But my own experience within Mormonism would be consistent with that, that what we're picking up with that question then would be something that has a particular meaning for Mormon women that doesn't apply maybe to women in other religions, which is a little ironic, but it seems that it's a lot safer, I guess you could say, or it doesn't call into question your devotion to the faith if, say, a Catholic or a Southern Baptist, those are two traditions that also do not have female clergy, of course, it seems to be safer within those faiths for women to say, well, I think they ought to be able to be clergy than you find within Mormonism.
Right. So there's a section in your book on politics and church, and at the very beginning, you're sure to be clear about the ambiguity that exists in doing this kind of research because of the way people interpret the questionnaire and what they might view as political versus moral speaking at church. But after you give that discussion of the ambiguity that's inherent in those studies, you go right into talking about the amount of politicking people experience over the pulpit. And the thing that surprised me, and I think would come to us as a surprise to many Mormons, is that Mormons experience very little politicking at church. And I think there's a lot of more liberal Mormons who feel like they can't get through even one section of church. You know, they can't get through gospel doctrine without hearing about Glenn Beck. So I was wondering if you could explain how that study was, or how that portion of your study was done, and what that result means.
So you're right to note that there's always some ambiguity or uncertainty when you ask people about politics at church, because what to one person may be a highly politicized sermon to another person may just be run-of-the-mill stuff that they'd expect to hear over the pulpit. And that's not just going to be true for Mormons. That's true for, you know, all religious groups. So when we ask people about political activity, we ask some items that are really quite concrete and specific. For example, we ask, does your congregation ever sponsor voter registration or get out the vote drive?
tribes. Those are activities that I would not expect Mormons to say they observe much, if ever, in their local wards and stakes. It's my understanding, actually, that it's against church policy to do such things.
Right.
We also ask whether your congregation ever sponsors marches, protests, or demonstrations. Again, I would be surprised if many LDS say that that happens often in their congregation. Perhaps during the Prop 8 campaign in California, some Mormons might have interpreted the door-to-door work that was being done there as being in the same vein, but it's still not quite the same thing as, you know, attending a march or a rally or something. But the third question in our item is one that is a little more ambiguous, I suppose, for Mormons, and that asks whether or not you've ever heard, or in the last month, you've heard a sermon on a moral a social or a political issue. And that's the one that's open to, you know, interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So a liberal Mormon might hear a sermon on, personal responsibility and hear it as an attack on the welfare state, and a conservative Mormon might hear that same sermon and say, well, that's just standard LDS doctrine. But I should note that it actually doesn't matter whether or not you put all three of those things together or whether you separate them out. Mormons still score pretty low on that overall measure or the individualized measures of how much political activity there is at church. Now, I want to be clear, that's just a reference to explicit politicking over the pulpit. And, you know, there are some religious traditions in the United States where it is not uncommon for a pastor to actually stand over the pulpit and speak very directly about particular candidates or particular issues that are in play. And I suspect that if you were to just go and talk casually with most Mormons, they would admit that that's a pretty rare thing in most wards. Again, that's quite different from the sort of in the hallway, in the classroom discussion sort of stuff where people typically assume that everybody else in the room thinks the same way they do and so throws out a reference to a Glenn Beck or to a Cleon Skousen or whatever. And in fact, our book does get into that sort of process. We call that the echo chamber effect. And we say that's actually where you find the real political impact of religious congregations, Mormon wards included, is the fact that most Americans who attend church on a regular basis are surrounded by people who share the same political beliefs. And therefore, they have those beliefs reinforced in all these sorts of conversations that they have either at church or through church channels.
Right. Something else that stuck out to me in that section of the book was that churches that have a more liberal approach to society tend to have more politicking over the pulpit. And there's one area in which Black Protestants and Mormons overlap in that way, and that's gay marriage, that they both experience a lot, or they at least reported to have experienced a lot of discussion about that at church, but in no other political topic.
That's right. Or actually, what the conclusion is not so much whether they've heard sermons on gay marriage. We didn't actually ask that, but it's just their attitudes on gay marriage line up. And it is true that the Black Church as an institution is one of the most politicized religious organizations in America. It stands right next to synagogues. Although even then, I don't want to overstate the amount of political activity you find in your typical Black church. You know, it's more than you find in most other traditions, but it's still not overwhelming. And it's just a fact that Black Protestants are an interesting group politically, because while they are quite liberal on many issues and almost monolithically supportive of the Democratic Party, that's not true when it comes to the particular issue of gay marriage. And of course, that was a part of the story for Prop 8 in California. It wasn't just Mormons who were favoring Prop 8. A lot of African Americans were as well.
Right. Okay, so changing gears just a little bit, another section of your book talked about how different religions view each other and how they view themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And Mormons came out as having the highest in-group attachment. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. So what we do is we ask people using something that sounds kind of hokey, but I assure you it works, known as a feeling thermometer. We ask people, well, using this feeling thermometer, where a 0 means you're very cold toward a group, 100 means you're very warm toward that group, and 50 means you're neutral, how would you rate the following groups? And then we ask, well, what about evangelical Christians, or what about Jews, or what about Catholics? Well, when you do that, what you find is that some groups like themselves more than others, but no group comes close to Mormons in terms of that, as you put it, in-group attachment. Mormons like themselves more than any other group, and that includes racial groups. Mormons like Mormons more than Blacks like Blacks, or Latinos like Latinos, which...
Right.
Probably speaks to the pseudo ethnic quality of a Mormon subculture.
Mm-hmm, definitely. So another thing that came out of the study was that Mormons, Muslims, and Buddhists are the least liked among all the religions.
That's right. So what we're able to do with this measure is compare how Americans perceive different religious groups. And whenever we're talking about these results, I should be clear that we actually take out members of that group itself when we're talking about how that group is perceived. So what that means is when we're talking mm-hmm. about perceptions of Catholics, that doesn't include how Catholics view Catholics. That's how everybody else
right.
does. And so that's true for all the other groups as well. And when you do that, you find that, as you mentioned, the three groups that rank at the bottom of our feeling thermometer, or loosely speaking, our popularity measure, are the Mormons, the Muslims, and the Buddhists. Now, we didn't ask about every possible religious group in America, so it's very well, it's very likely that there are other groups that will also be clustered in there. In fact, I suspect that Hindus and Sikhs and Jains would also be there.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it's those three groups is quite interesting. Mormons, you know, perhaps that's not surprising. And Muslims, I doubt that's surprising to anyone. Buddhists, a little more so. In fact, we asked about Buddhists specifically because we wanted to think of a group that was somewhat exotic, maybe, or foreign sounding to many Americans, but nonetheless mm-hmm. innocuous. And so we came up with the Buddhists, because it's hard to think of any negative press that would be associated with the Buddhist community. Maybe there are a bunch of anti-Richard Gere people out there, but other than that, I laugh. So what that tells us is it's not just terrorism in the case.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just polygamy or any other baggage that the term Mormon might carry. There's something else going on here. And of course, we speculate and maybe do a little more than speculate. And think we show some evidence that it has to do with familiarity with members of that religion. These are three groups that most Americans are not personally familiar with. They don't know a Mormon, a Muslim, or a Buddhist.
Right. You also mentioned that these are three groups, along with, you know, Sikhs and Hindus and other religions like that, they're not considered as having a seat at the Protestant Judeo-Christian table, right?
Right. They're often thought of as the other or being somewhat alien. And of course, that comes to the great frustration of many Mormons, and you know, sort of goes back to the big debate of whether Mormons should be considered Christians or not. And if you don't consider Mormons to be Christians, well, then they're definitely an other. And,
right.
And that explains at least, you know, some people's reactions to Mormons.
Right. So, yeah, you mentioned that Mormons are considered other, and I want to go back to that a little bit later because I found that part of the book where you talk about my Aunt Susan and my friend Al. I thought that was a very interesting part of the book, but before we get there, I have a few more questions to ask. And actually, before we even leave the topic of the in-group attachments, something that stuck out to me in the table that showed the way one religion views another is that, and this is completely an aside, Black Protestants gave Buddhists the lowest rating out of any group. So most, if I remember correctly, I don't have the book, I loaned it to a friend, but if I remember correctly, most groups scored in the 60s, 50s, 40s, but the Buddhists were scored like 35 or something by the Black Protestants. And I was wondering if you ever, did you find anything in particular between that relationship that caused the number to be so low? Or is it just that so small of a group that Black Protestants just don't have that much interaction with them?
I think it would be the latter. And maybe another way to ask it would be, well, why do Black Protestants, who are a highly religious group and a highly conservative group theologically, not necessarily politically, but theologically, why would they view Muslims reasonably high and Buddhists reasonably low? You might expect mm-hmm. them to view both of those groups somewhat similarly, which is the way many Americans think of them. Mm-hmm. Our explanation for that is actually the Black Muslim movement, that if you're African-American
right.
in this country, the chances are you know someone who is Muslim. And if you don't know them personally, you're certainly aware of many prominent, obviously, African-Americans who are Muslim, whether it be Malcolm X or Muhammad Ali or Kareem Abdul-Jabbar or whoever else.
Right. People that are venerated in their
yeah.
culture.
So I suspect that if we asked about other clearly non-Christian and non-Jewish, the Jews are not Christians, obviously, but they're kind of an exception because mm-hmm. they're viewed quite warmly.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask about another group like the Sikhs or the Hindus, I suspect that Black Protestants would also rate them fairly low.
Okay, I see what you mean. So the In that section, you also talked about what makes people true believer of their faith and what groups had the highest level of consideration for other faiths as making it to heaven. And one of the results of the study showed that Mormons have the highest level of belief that salvation is open to everybody and not just the members of their own faith. And I was wondering, in that particular set of questions, were you able to tease out for the Mormon participants specifically whether or not that meant exaltation or just getting into heaven?
You ask a very good question, and it's a good example of how asking a question that would seem to be pretty straightforward can nonetheless vary in its meaning from one religious tradition to another. So asking the Mormon, do you believe someone who is not of your faith can go to heaven, is probably going to be interpreted in a very different way than, say, a Protestant or a Catholic might answer that question. Mm-hmm. For at least two reasons. One, that you mentioned, that there's this idea that within Mormon doctrine that there are different degrees or levels of heaven, obviously. So maybe when Mormons are answering that question, they're thinking, well, okay, yeah, they're not going to go to the celestial kingdom, they're going to go to some other kingdom, but that's still heaven, so I'm going to say yes. And it also includes the complication that obviously Mormons believe in posthumous salvation, right? Mm-hmm. That you can baptize for the dead and do other ordinances for those who are no longer living. I actually think, however, that even with those qualifications and trying to provide a little nuance to how Mormons answer that question, that it's still a pretty powerful thing to know that this many Mormons are willing to say, yes, actually, people I know who are not of my faith can nonetheless go to heaven, even if they're thinking, but I have to go to the temple and do their work for them first, or the heaven they're going to go to is not quite the full heaven, but it's still something. I think that still is a powerful message that Mormons themselves, I would hope, would be a little more conscious of and sort of think about the fact that their own doctrine teaches that everyone around them is entitled to the same opportunities that they are. And you know, when I speak to non-Mormon audiences, I've actually had this question, isn't it true the Mormons believe they can baptize people who are dead? I said, well, yes, but that still says something about how they view or how they ought to view the people around them here in mortality.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That they're not, Mormons shouldn't consider other people so much of an out-group because they have the ability to be brought in to the in-group at some point in the future.
That's right. And there actually is some evidence that Mormons do think that way. Because Mormons in general give all these other religious groups that we've mentioned pretty high ratings.
Right. The chart showed very clearly that Mormons loved everybody else, but not very many other people loved them.
That's right.
In that way. Anyway.
Which either means we're Mormons are the eternal optimists or we're played for suckers.
One of the two. So another question in that section was the qualification of whether or not somebody is a true believer of their faith. And according to the survey, only 30% of Mormons are true believers. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. Now, that question that we asked actually has three options for your answer. You can either say there's no truth in any religion, and you know a little less than 10% of Americans choose that option. You can say that there is only one true religion, which presumably would be your own religion. Or you can say that there are many truths in, or there are truths in many religions. And it's true that only 30% of Mormons say that there's only one true religion, although, notably, that is the highest percentage of any religious group, actually by, I think it's fair to say, a long shot. So clearly some Mormons are interpreting that as a question about the standard line that you hear in an LDS testimony, I believe the church is true, or this is the restored church, you know, that sort of language. But then some other portion of Mormons are hearing that, and they're thinking of sort of the other side of Mormon teachings, which is that, well, all truth is circumscribed into one great whole, there are truths to be found in other faiths, it's just not the complete truth, that sort of thing. And so I think for Mormons, what you find is kind of a tension between those two options that we give people. I think if we had just asked, do you believe there's not truth in any religion or that one religion is true and all the others are false, then a much higher percentage of Mormons would have chosen the one religion is true option. But again, that's still an important thing to know. Many Mormons are willing to say, yeah, there are truths in many religions.
Yeah, and I think that's something that most people would probably concede and that they would, or I guess concede's the wrong word, but they would agree with that there is truth in other religions. But yeah, I guess the reason that kind of struck me as interesting is that in the community of people that I interact with, which tend to be more liberal Mormons or disaffected Mormons. True believers, TBM, means something a little different. So it would, you know, come as a shock if you're reading along with that, you know, frame of reference for what that term means, to find out that only 30% of the church are true believers. But
that's it. Although I should note that, again, Mormons are the highest, have the highest percentage of that. And the church's website, LDS.org, they did a thing on American Grace, and they made a point of noting that Mormons were the most likely to say that theirs is the one true church.
One true church,
yes. That's a specific percentage.
Yeah, I didn't want to let them know it was only 30%, huh? So I have a few questions about things that struck me as I was reading. On page 142, so it's fairly early in the book, there's a statement that says that outside of ethnicity, ordinary demographic factors such as gender and education make very little difference in retention rates. And I'm wondering, were you able to look specifically at Mormonism with that data, or was your pool too small? Because my just my anecdotal experience is that more men tend to become disaffected than women. Do you know what I mean? And end up in sort of an interfaith marriage.
Well, it is true that in general, women are more religious than men, and that's true in Mormonism as in every other religious tradition. And it is interesting that even in spite of the fact that women are on average more religious than men, kind of no matter how you measure it, we still don't see a gender difference in terms of retention. Now, I do have to admit, however, as you implied, because we don't have all that many Mormons in this study, which is exactly what you'd expect. There aren't all that many Mormons in the country. And even with a large sample like ours, you still only get, you know, a certain number. We're not really able to subdivide and parse within the Mormon population. But I can tell you that research continues, and I have some collaborators, and we are intending to hopefully do a survey specifically of Mormons. So we would draw a sample of Mormons in particular, and that would enable us to dig a little deeper into these sorts of questions.
Into those issues. Yeah, well, I'm interested in how that will turn out. So another thing that stuck out to me is there was a section where you broke down demographics of the country and you made maps that showed where there's a high concentration of Germans and a high concentration of Lutherans, and they tend to overlap, and then a high concentration of, I can't remember if it was conservatives or people considered themselves Americans and evangelicals, and those things tend to overlap. And then in the text, you mentioned that evangelicals and Mormons are most likely out of any other group to identify their ethnicity as American, as opposed to German or Jewish or whatever. And can you explain why the reason that you came up with for why that would be?
Well, if you think of what characterizes both evangelical Protestantism and Mormonism, both of these are faith traditions that are built on the whole idea of converting others. They're evangelistic faith. They're proselytizing faith. And in order to sustain a proselytizing faith, you really can't build your religion around an ethnic identity, because if you want to convert a lot of people, you need to be converting them from many different ethnicities. And so I actually found it quite striking, and it's very clear in the data, actually, that this is one case where evangelicals and Mormons really stand out and look a lot like one another. And I think that's a very, for me anyway, convincing explanation that there just isn't an ethnic component to Mormonism or most evangelical Protestant churches in the way that there is in Lutheranism or in many Catholic parishes or certainly within Judaism.
Right. That's the thing that kind of stuck out to me, was that if you stay with the religion of your homeland, you're probably also in a community that's sticking with other, or putting emphasis on other traditions that came from your homeland. So if you're sticking with Lutheranism from Germany, you're probably also doing several other things that are very German. And evangelicalism and Mormonism are two religions that are kind of USA grown.
That's right.
Evangelicalism, I believe evangelicalism started with persecuted Christians in, you know, Great Britain coming here as the Puritans and setting up their, you know, their traditional faith here. And it kind of morphed and changed, obviously, into what we have now. And Mormonism obviously started up here. So if you're abandoning, you know, the religion of where you came from for the religion that's here in the United States, then perhaps it would be, especially in evangelicalism and Mormonism, sorry, I'm blabbering on here, but evangelicalism and Mormonism are very consuming religions that, you know what I mean, are you're expected to apply them to your whole entire life as opposed to have them just a separate portion. So I could see how that would make you identify with where you currently live as opposed to, you know, where your ancestors came.
That's right. And, you know, in Mormonism, we don't celebrate feast days associated with, you know, the patron saint of any particular country. We don't hold festivals to commemorate our Greek heritage or our Slavic heritage or, you know, whatever else you might find in various more ethnically rooted religions.
Right. Definitely. So something else that stuck out to me, you spent some time looking at Latinos, and they're by and large Catholic. And if they're not Catholic, it turns out that they're evangelical Christian. At least that's like the next biggest percentage of where they fall, you know, demographically. And that kind of surprised me because it seems like the church puts a lot of focus on the work that they do in Central and South America. And so for some reason, I just thought that there would be a huge contingent of LDS Latinos that would surpass evangelicals. And I was wondering if you noticed that or if that's just a bias of having grown up in places where there's a large Latino population.
Well, it's, I think, a case of how nationwide data doesn't always jibe with our own personal experience because you find variation in these things in particular regions. If you, you know, think of the fact that Mormons as a whole are only about 2-3% of the whole U.S. population, and, you know, even if, and this is much higher than it really is, but even if half of all Mormons were Latino, that would still only be 1.5% of the U.S. population. And, you know, if you sort of multiply that through the number of Latinos in the country, that would still be a relatively small proportion. So you could still actually end up with a pretty large number of Latinos within the Mormon population, but that still wouldn't represent a huge chunk of the overall Latino population in the U.S. And that's what you're finding.
Right. So it's kind of a... my own personal experience, I'm expecting it to apply over the whole country when in fact it's a very small percentage.
That's right.
So here's something that was of my own particular interest. It doesn't necessarily apply to the discussion at large, but it's something that I was talking to a friend at work about. He's quite liberal, and he always bemoans the fact that conservatives are considered the generous people. There's always studies that come out that say conservatives give more than liberals, and it drives him crazy because he's convinced that if they took out things like tithing or spending time doing church callings or specifically serving whatever church you belong to, that liberals would actually come out ahead in their charitable gifts. Giving. And I was wondering if you separated those things out, if charitable giving included tithing paid to churches or time spent doing work for the building up of a particular religion, or if it was all looked at as just charitable giving.
Well, there's good news and there's bad news for your friend. Let me start with the bad news. The bad news is our study, at least, I can't speak to other studies, but our study does separate out what we call secular giving versus religious giving. Now, it's clear that in some cases, again, there's ambiguity over what counts as religious giving versus secular. If you give money to Catholic charities, is that religious or secular? It's kind of hard to say. If you give money to the Boy Scouts and you're LDS, does that mean you're giving to a religious cause or a secular cause? That's also a little hard to say. But for the most part, Americans do seem to be able to separate out what they mean by religious giving versus secular giving. And the way the survey works is we actually have a lot of categories. We've done this before in other surveys, so we've learned a little bit about how to ask people these questions. You kind of have to get them thinking about all the different ways that they might contribute to charity, whether it be their money or their time. And even when you separate out secular versus religious, you still find that religious people, okay, I want to qualify that, religious people more likely to give both to religious causes, no surprise there, but also secular causes than are secular people, okay? And it's also the case that many religious people are conservative. So you just sort of leave it at that. Yeah, it's true, conservatives give more to charity than liberals. However, and here's the good news for your friend, the story is actually a little more complicated when you think about both religion and political ideology, because if you put both of those into the story, by which I mean, you know, you examine them both statistically, it turns out that the most generous group are religious liberals. And that runs counter to some of the other chatter that you find about charitable giving in the U.S. There was a book a few years ago by a fellow named Arthur Brooks who entitled, I think it was Who Really Cares? And, you know, that it's conservatives who give more than liberals. Well, actually, if you accounted for religiosity, what you'd find is that it's really the religious liberals who are giving and not the religious conservatives.
That's really interesting. I remember seeing a news report by John Stossel, I believe, one of those 2020 type things. And I think they measured their generosity by doing things like putting charitable giving containers, kind of like you see with the Salvation Army, in conservative areas versus liberal areas to see who gave more money. So actually what they were selecting for there might have been religiosity, and they didn't realize it.
Yeah, that's entirely possible.
That's actually very interesting, I think.
I might also, I don't know if I'd put anything that, you know, Stossel or anybody else does on to the...
Well, at the very least, my friend will be happy. Okay, so the next question I had for you was involves trusting and a loving God. And according to the book, and this is actually found on page 469, so religions that are more fundamentalist and don't view God as very loving are less trusting of people around them. And I was wondering what you think about that in regards to Mormonism, because a lot of people would consider Mormonism to be a very fundamentalist religion, obviously not compared to, you know, say the polygamous sects that are down in southern, you know, Utah. But in looking at religion in general, Mormons are more of a fundamentalist religion, but they're more trusting and they don't really believe in a loving God. Do you see what I'm getting at? I'm wondering if you notice that in your results.
This is a case where a term like fundamentalist can mean different things in different contexts. When we speak of fundamentalists, we actually have a little index, a series of questions that we've asked people that we believe enable us to, you know, suss out who are the real fundamentalists. And it turns out actually not that many Mormons fall into our category of fundamentalists defined the way we do it. It asks the question we mentioned earlier about whether there's one true faith. Okay, lots of Mormons, not a majority by any means, but lots of Mormons say yes to that. But we also ask things like, do you believe that the Bible should be taken literally? Well, most Mormons actually don't believe that.
Right.
Do you believe that, we ask an evolution question, and, you know, Mormons are sort of in the middle. We kind of look like a lot of other Americans on evolution. What else did we ask? Anyway, there's a series of other questions that when you put them all together, it turns out that Mormons don't necessarily score that highly on that particular index. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't other ways in which we might use the word fundamentalist to describe some of the beliefs that your typical Mormon holds. It just doesn't necessarily, those questions don't necessarily fit into our particular index. And that's why you get the result you do, which is that, you know, most Mormons actually are a little more likely to believe in a loving rather than a judgmental God.
So according to the standards used for your study, Mormonism isn't terribly fundamentalist.
That's right. Again, though, using the particular definition of fundamentalism that we develop in the book, which I think is defensible, when most people think of fundamentalists, they're actually thinking of a branch of Protestantism.
Right, right. Okay, so the next question I have is that when you were talking about religious faith and politics, it seemed like homosexuality and abortion were the two hot-button issues that kind of pushed people one way or the other in terms of their political ideology and faith. And there's a lot of talk in the LDS Church that, well, I guess I shouldn't say it's coming from the LDS Church, it's amongst the populace, you know, it's amongst the members, that you can't be a good Mormon and be a liberal, or you can't be a good Mormon and be a Democrat. And I was wondering if you saw any of that in the data that you were looking at, or if you see that in other faiths, that you can't be a good Black Protestant and be conservative, or if that's kind of unique to Mormonism.
I would not say it's unique to Mormonism. In fact, I think going back to this echo chamber effect that I mentioned earlier, there are many religious groups where you find people who are like-minded politically congregating together. For Mormons, that means Republicans largely. For Jews, that means Democrats. For Black Protestants, it means Democrats. For many evangelicals, it would again mean Republican. So I don't think Mormons are actually unusual in that particular way, except that Mormons are so overwhelmingly Republican that really the only group they come close to is, in terms of their political monotheism, are Black Protestants, who are almost monolithically Democratic. So they're on the other side of the scale. Although Jews are pretty Democratic, and, you know, Evangelicals are largely Republican.
Right. So on page 82, you refer to prudes and libertines forcing people to choose one side or the other, and it's causing the middle to drop out. So people who don't consider themselves, you know, extreme one way or the other on issues like abortion and homosexuality. And I was wondering, and this might be your own personal experience or what you've experienced with presenting this book, or maybe from the research you did with this book, but do you see that happening with Mormonism? Because when I was first starting to have problems with the church, I guess you could say, that's kind of how I felt, that I was kind of being forced out because it was either like this extreme or you're not a part of the group. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. Well, do you see that a lot?
Well, we should be clear that the particular discussion you're referring to, the libertines versus prudes, is actually a reference to just simply attitudes toward sex and premarital sex in particular. But I think the point you're making applies more generally. I think what you would find within Mormonism, but also other faiths that have doctrines and beliefs and teachings that are fairly strict and also fairly uniform, you know, across members of the faith, that the situation you're describing is not unusual. I think there was once a time when what you were describing was probably more common among Catholics, although today I doubt that there's so much of a concern within Catholicism that everyone has to toe the same line, because Catholicism is such a diverse religion. I certainly see that teaching at Notre Dame. But I also imagine that kind of at the local level, you would find what you're describing within a lot of Protestant congregations. You know, a particular Protestant congregation will, as a congregation, have a set of beliefs that they endorse, and people who don't necessarily endorse those may not feel very comfortable in that particular place of worship.
Okay. So I want to go back to my Aunt Susan and my friend Al. Can you explain what those principles are and how you came up with them?
Sure. So this is our attempt to explain social science using hypothetical people that we hope our readers can remember.
Mm-hmm.
When we refer to your Aunt Susan, what we mean is that person whom you know in your family is the kindest, sweetest person ever. This is the person who never forgets your birthday. She's the one who works at the homeless shelter. She's the one who brings the casseroles to the sick people. Right? She's that person. And you know that your Aunt Susan is destined for heaven.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is you also know that Aunt Susan is of a different faith than you. Maybe you're Mormon and she's Lutheran, or you're and she's Catholic, and your theology teaches that only your team gets to go to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, you know Aunt Susan, and Aunt Susan is destined for heaven. So you have to make a choice between your theology and Aunt Susan. And it turns out that almost all Americans, when faced with that choice, actually go with Aunt Susan. She wins. And so, you know, Americans just basically discard their own theology on the question of who is entitled to go to heaven. And I should mention that even though we've given a cutesy name to that, we actually do have some empirical data to support that very idea. Almost all of us have an Aunt Susan in our family, and there's good reason to think that having someone close to you who is of another faith, particularly, you know, a loved one, really does foster a sense of religious tolerance and acceptance.
Yeah. Right.
The reference to my friend or my pal Al is similar. That's the idea that we often make friends with people who, regardless of their religious affiliation, we make friends with them because they are a neighbor or a coworker, or they share a hobby or an interest of ours. And then along the way, within the course of this friendship, we come to learn that that person whom we like and admire is actually of a different faith. So in the book, you use sort of the cheeky example of beekeeping. Imagine that you have a friend, Al, who's a beekeeper. You're a beekeeper. You do whatever beekeepers do and become close friends. And then along the way, you discover that Al is an evangelical Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, evangelical Christians who you had demonized previously don't seem so bad because, well, here's Al. He's one of them, and he seems to be an okay guy. Again,
right.
That sounds like kind of a cutesy thing. Like we should all just hold hands and sing kumbaya. But I can attest that we really do have empirical evidence that shows when you become friends with people of other faiths, you actually become warmer, not only to people of that faith. So become friends with an evangelical, you become warmer toward evangelicals, but you actually become a little warmer toward other religions that are not represented among your friends. That's the amazing thing. So become friends with an evangelical, and you actually become warmer toward Mormons.
Because you start to realize that maybe you shouldn't be so skeptical towards outgroups.
Exactly. That's the working hypothesis. And lots of people have actually hypothesized that that's the way this is described in the psychology literature, social contact, that that's the way social contact works. But it turns out that there's really not a lot of empirical evidence to show that that is really what happens, and we've managed to uncover some.
Hmm. Okay. So these two principles you Dr. Putnam used to explain why America can be such a religiously diverse society and yet be kind of cohesive. And I believe what you say in the book is that this is America's grace. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. What we mean is, if you look around the world, America actually has a unique combination of three things. We are a religiously devout country, we are religiously diverse, and we're also somewhat religiously tolerant. For all the reasons we've mentioned in this interview, the fact that most Americans are willing to believe that others who are not of their faith can go to heaven, and we have some other evidence that suggests that Americans are very accepting of those of other religions. That's a puzzling combination. It might be easy to see how we would all be sort of fine with other religions if we weren't terribly devout, or even if we weren't terribly diverse, but put them all together and you might think that that would be a combination for violence or mayhem rather than a relatively peaceful coexistence. So, you know, think of places in the world that combine religious devotion and diversity, and you might think of Belfast or Baghdad or places like that.
Right.
The term America's grace, as we use it in the book, refers to the fact that almost unwittingly, Americans have managed to figure out how to keep a society like that together. And we've done so by building these bridges across different religions. The fact that we've managed to, over the last generation especially, bring people together who are of different faiths in our families, certainly in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces, etc. That constitutes the grace that kind of enables America to combine those three things: religious devotion, diversity, and tolerance.
Good. Okay. So since I was viewing this whole book through the framework of interviewing you and looking at it for specifically Mormon reasons, I have to say that when I looked at the Aunt Susan and My Pal Al principles, it kind of instilled in me a hope that maybe those principles can work to help people who are on the fringes of the LDS community. Because it seems like to me, and this isn't like a, you know, horrible problem that's ruining people's lives everywhere you look, but there's quite a few people who, when they become disaffected or find themselves on the fringes of Mormonism, suddenly they're considered the other, and they're treated poorly by their neighbors, and they have problems with their family. And it's my hope that this My Aunt Susan and My Friend Al, maybe over the course of history, you know, as people have more, if people have more friends that are disaffected or who don't fit the mold of the typical Mormon, that maybe those problems will become fewer or less common. And I was wondering what you think about that.
Oh, I think that the data do more than suggest. They actually make it pretty clear that that's precisely what we'd expect to find. But of course, whether or not these principles work in particular the LDS community in reference to active Mormons and their attitudes toward, Jeff Burton refers to the borderlanders or, you know, people who are, as you put it, on the periphery or on the fringes of Mormonism. For that to happen, it would actually require for those social relationships to be built. And that's a real challenge, actually, for Mormons because of that in-group attachment I referred to earlier. There's all sorts of evidence that we show in the book. It just kept popping up that Mormons are really distinctive when it comes to how much in-group bonding goes on. Now, we only asked about, you know, Mormons bonding with Mormons, and so I don't know if you ask a typical Mormon, you know, about their closest friends, how many are Mormon, are they counting less active Mormons or disaffected Mormons in that group? I don't know, but I suspect they're not. And if they're not, it would mean that in order for the process to unfold the way you've described, those believing Mormons, devout Mormons, however you want to put it, the language is a little tricky here, but whatever we want to call it,
right.
They would actually need to reach out to the disaffected Mormons, and likewise, the disaffected Mormons would also have to be able and willing to reach out to the others. And that's a tricky thing. You know, that's the fact of the matter is these are social relationships that can often be fraught with tension.
Definitely. So those are the questions and the things that I was interested in talking about with you today. Just to wrap up, how has your book been received? Do you get a lot of people asking you about it or talking to you about it at church or in, you know, amongst your social circle? How do people view the book?
Well, we have fortunately been able to receive a number of reviews in all sorts of publications. We've been reviewed by basically some publication or some leader of pretty well every major religious tradition in America, including within LDS circles, where it wasn't a review per se, but there was a talk given in the most recent general conference that specifically cited American Grace, and then in another speech that he gave, Dallin H. Oaks also cited it, so we sort of took that as approval from within the LDS community. We've had very nice reviews from Reformed Jews and from within Catholic publications and evangelical publications, et cetera, et cetera. So it's been received quite positively. Ironically, this is quite typical, actually, of an academic. It's suppose many of the people I know personally are sort of aware that I've written this book, and that would include people within my own congregation, my own ward. I don't mm-hmm. know whether any of them have actually read it.
Oh.
So I'm the guy who's, you know, co-author of this big book, but that doesn't mean they actually
have got out, right.
read it or, you know, can talk to me about it. But some have, so every once in a while.
Good. Interesting. Okay. So what do you have planned for the future? Are you doing more research like this?
I am. There's actually a paperback version of American Grace coming out soon. It will include a new chapter based on new data. So we are going back to the same people we interviewed in 2006. And then in 2007, we've gone back to them. We're actually just finishing up the interviews now. So we'll be able to answer all sorts of questions like religion and the Tea Party and what happens to religion over the course of a huge recession, because that's occurred since we last talked to people. So that's one of our things that we'll be doing. I'm also beginning work specifically on a book about Mormons and politics, trying to capture or capitalize on the Mormon moment, as many people are calling it. I have a couple of collaborators, so not Putnam, but others, who with me, we've written a little bit about Mormons and their political views, and we've done a bunch of experiments where we've tested how voters react to the news that, say, Mitt Romney or Harry Reid is a Mormon, and, you know, what... Who reacts negatively and who reacts positively. And we have enough that we think we have a book in the works.
Oh, I'll be interested in reading that. So before we end our conversation today, is there anything else that you wanted to add?
There's one thing that I like to mention whenever I speak about American Grace to an LDS or an LDS-oriented audience. And maybe this is preaching to the choir for those who might be listening to this podcast, but just in case it's not, you know, we talked about the in-group attachment and the bonding, you might even call it the insularity of the Mormon community. And if there's one thing that I say to Mormon audiences, and I said it at BYU and I said it at Southern Virginia University, and I'll continue to say it, is Mormons as a group need to do more to bridge to other religions. It is amazing how Mormons stand out on these measures of in-group bonding. And it is no coincidence that Mormons are the group most likely to have in-group ties versus out-group ties. There's no coincidence that they score high on that, and at the same time are also one of the least popularly regarded or least positively viewed religions in America. There's a direct connection between those. If Mormons want to be taken seriously as part of the religious mainstream in America, then they need to be willing to reach out to their neighbors who are not LDS.
Definitely. I definitely agree. And I think there was a statistic that came out showing that the percentage of people who would vote for a Mormon has not changed since Mitt Romney's father has
That's right.
ran.
Yeah,
right?
It's actually stunning. So Gallup asked the standard question, if someone of your party was qualified, was nominated, who happened to be a blank, would you vote for that person? And they put different things in the blank, but they put Mormon occasionally. And there's been no change from 1968 when George Romney ran. And it's roughly 25-30% of the American population say that they would not vote for a Mormon. And that holds up no matter how you ask the question. You can be sneaky. You can be upfront. You can give people all sorts of obfuscating things in the question and get exactly the same response every time, which interestingly is about the same percentage of Americans who said they would not vote for a Catholic in 1960 when John F. Kennedy ran and won as the first Catholic president.
Oh, so it's not necessarily a statistic that dooms a Mormon candidate, but it's something that definitely shows that Mormonism needs to up their game in getting more friend owls or becoming
that's
more
right.
pal
and,
owls.
You know, assuming that Mitt Romney is going to, I don't know if he'll win the Republican nomination, but he's definitely in that top tier of candidates. I think the big question is whether Mitt Romney will prove to be Mormonism's John F. Kennedy, the one who breaks the stained glass ceiling for Mormons, or will he prove to be our Al Smith, who was the first Catholic nominated for president in 1928, who didn't do so well.
Right. All right. Well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it. And I think that there are a lot of interesting things in this book that we didn't have time to get to, but I took lots of notes and I plan on trying to spark some conversations when we get this posted to the website. So hopefully everybody will read these things and be interested and go out and buy the book and start thinking about these things.
Well, I've enjoyed my time. I hope that your listeners find this interesting. And if you do, feel free to pick up a copy of American Grace or even just get it from the library so you don't think I'm just shilling for books.
All right. Well, thank you. And like always, the discussion continues at MormonExpression.com.